Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. And over the past several months, we've spent a lot of time discussing the future threat environment and what it means to send bombers and fighters into harm's way. Well, guess what? That's only part of the equation. No military force can operate for any period of time without a robust flow of supplies. Whether discussing munitions, spare parts, food, fuel, or medical supplies, the reality is the scale, scope, and pace of combat operations fundamentally relies on logistics. And to put it into context, when Winston Churchill was asked about what worried him most during World War II, he focused on logistics, responding that, quote, "The only thing that ever really frightened me during the war was the U-boat peril," end quote. And as you know, Britain was fundamentally dependent on shipping across the Atlantic for supplies. The German submarines, which were called U-boats, were sinking Allied ships at a tremendous rate, effectively starving the UK of everything it needed, not just to fight, but to survive. And think about this. He was a leader who lived through Dunkirk, the Battle of Britain, D-Day, the Battle of the Bulge, and countless other challenges. Maintaining logistic flows was the top of his concerns. Now, we need to take that message to heart today, because we may find ourselves in a similar situation if we're not careful. With the return of great power competition, we are going to find all elements of our military enterprise under attack, and the results could prove disastrous if we don't lean into developing and implementing proactive solutions. And I'd stack logistics at the top of this list. So that's what we're going to talk about today, sustaining the force through global mobility, with particular focus on the air aspect of this equation. And joining us to discuss this is Mitchell Institute Dean, Lieutenant General Dave Deptula, and the Air Force Air Mobility Command Commander, General Jackie Van Obus, who's been nominated to serve as the head of U.S. Transportation Command, the overarching mobility lead for the entire DOD. So with that, General Deptula, thanks so much for being here. And before we get General Van Obus up on the line, could I get your take on this issue?
Slick, you bet. Your setup on this topic is spot on. Think about it. An enemy doesn't even have to shoot down one of our bombers or fighters to negate their combat effect if it can choke off the supplies that allow those combat aircraft to operate. And this isn't hard to do, right? Because for the past 30 years, we built a logistics system optimized for permissive circumstances that reflect what we'd expect to see during peacetime. The focus on things like just-in-time logistics and other concepts prioritized efficiency to the exclusion of military effectiveness when the shooting starts. We were striving to become FedEx or UPS, and that's a huge problem because our adversaries know this and they prepare to hit our supply flows hard. It's a lot easier to defeat an F-22 by choking off its fuel supply versus actually shooting it down in the air. And this is a consequence of bringing on secretaries of defense with business experience and not warfighting experience. And we have to stop that trend.
Sir, it really hits the nail on the head. And just thinking back to our combat operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, or even your experiences in Desert Storm, just think how much we relied on commercial airlift. Specifically, I'm talking airliner 747s flying into a war zone. There's no way that's going to last against a peer adversary. And yet we rely on these types of conduits so much right now. The whole system was built for it.
Exactly. But here's the good news. Air Force leaders have realized this vulnerability. In fact, if you look at recent Mitchell Institute publications, you'll see that both Lieutenant General Warren Berry, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Logistics, and our guest today, General Van Obus of Air Mobility Command, have published on this topic this year. This is a very good thing, and it represents the tip of the iceberg regarding everything that's going on in this lane. So, Slick, let's turn to General Van Obus and hear from one of our nation's top experts in this zone. General, thanks so very much for being here today.
Hi, David Slick. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here to talk with you again.
So what I'd like to do is set the scene for our listeners. When did you and your colleagues realize things needed to change when it came to projecting logistics under attack? Was the 2018 National Defense Strategy a big part of this shift?
Well, I'll tell you, for me, I really started seeing some indications of this around 2015, 2016 timeframe. And one big event that comes to mind immediately, particularly when it comes to pertinent to logistics, my field, happened in the summer of 2017. That was the Maersk cyber attack by Russia as a consequence of a spillover of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. That was pretty much an eye-opener. This is a major international transportation company that was essentially came to full stop due to this malware attack. Think of it, a near-peer attack on another state, their logistics enterprise. It kicked off the concerns of this returning strategic competition. And then at the same time, you remember that China was exerting increasing economic and military influence throughout the South China Sea, was challenging U.S. allies and partner interests, as well as the international norms like freedom of navigation. And they were building islands and bases out of what they were building. So I think the 2018 National Defense Strategy provided that clarity and urgency to this frame, to this trend, and helped frame the problem and drive action across the department. Really pointed to a new era where old solutions simply would not win, and it drove new thinking. And in AMC, that meant for us doing our part in integrating logistics with all warfighting functions so the joint force can effectively close that kill chain. It means a drive towards the joint concept for contested logistics and Air Force's logistics under attack efforts that recognize that to overcome a long contested line of communication, we need joint, persistent, pulsed, and integrated logistics to project and sustain the joint force.
General Van Obos, when it comes to sustaining mobility and logistic flows under fire, what are the main pieces in play and how do you assess the respective threats from each component? There are strategic airlift lines, but then there's also a lot of intra-theater airlift, aero refueling, aero medical evacuation, plus supplies that are stored forward, things like fuel and various supply depots.
Yeah, that's a great question, Slick, and a wide-ranging one with huge impacts given the new warfighting concepts. Look, the threats we face are persistent. They're cross-domain, kinetic, and non-kinetic. And our mission is to deliver combat power, ammunition, fuel, and food to disaggregated physical locations, really driving demand for more stuff to more places more frequently. But to do that in a contested environment, decision advantage is essential through connection and information. The environment is so dynamic that we must connect the right data to the right decision maker at echelon at the right time. Sensing, make sense, decide and act, forging better, faster, more effective decisions. So key to us is to deal with these kinds of threats is to understand the data and identify where and what that right data is and know how to move it and where it needs to go in order to harness it for decisions. You know, I think about for sustaining logistic flows under attack, I break it into three pieces that span all of our rapid global mobility missions. The first is posture. The second is our capability and capacity. And the last is our ability to command and control. For posture, it's about what should be pre-positioned given those inherent risks, the capability of our logistics nodes, access, basing, and overflight, which is critical to meeting our objectives, and a key part of our relationship building with our allies and partners. Focusing on those allies and partners, we have to understand and incorporate their capabilities and limitations, integrating with them to achieve outcomes based on our mutual values and interests. I think of Defender Pacific as an example. Recently, we had C-17s airdropping U.S. and Indonesian airborne forces side by side, demonstrating both capability and strengthening our partnership. And working to become more interoperable, operating common equipment, spare parts, supply lines, refueling and turning each other's aircraft. These are the kinds of things we have to get after. And for our capabilities and capacity, we have to have multiple options to move the joint force. I think of our commercial augmentation and craft. We have to be closely linked to our commercial partners to ensure interoperability and work toward things like real-time information sharing and command and control integration in order to utilize our commercial capacity in new ways. I think of our total force, active duty, guard and reserve as vital to our capacity. We simply cannot do this without our total force partners, who have in some cases taken the lead for new tactics, techniques, and procedures, and even new capability development. And look, connection is the baseline for entry in strategic competition. Our platforms must be on the network, capable to connect in order to survive and generate the effects required. And then C2, right? Connection facilitates decision advantage through resilient C2, harnessing the data, creating info, and moving it to the decision maker at the right echelon at machine speeds is vital. Not only does the connection improve our situational awareness and survivability, it increases joint force COA development and decision speed, bringing the joint functions together to enhance the kill chain effects. So I tell you, look, it's a long answer, but you asked a pretty critical question in the heart of what we're doing here. Integrated, resilient, and connected is our posture, capabilities, capacity, and C2, leveraging that information for decision advantage, and integrating logistics planning with all of our joint warfighting functions are going to be key to countering these threats in the future.
General, do airlift requirements adequately factor the vulnerability of cargo airplanes and air refuelers to air and missile attacks, both on U.S. logistics hubs in the Indo-Pacific? And they can obviously be shot down, too. What kind of considerations are taken into play with this respect?
Yeah, Dave, if we had this conversation a few years ago, the answer would be no. The answer would be not considered, right? You know, the past mobility capability requirements study just didn't factor that in, right? And that wasn't a requirement. But I tell you, the new mobility capability requirements study, which was conducted by Transcom in coordination with the joint staff, our services and COCOMs, had the objective of determining, you know, how much was enough in terms of accomplishing these necessary mobility missions at an acceptable level of risk measured against NDS 18. And we looked at the missions to compete daily, which, as you know, stresses our force almost just as much. The study looked at our contested environment with kinetic and non-kinetic threats. And they provided their recommendations within the context of our current fleet capacity for each type of mobility platform, including our commercial platforms. So this study is now with the services for their evaluation of how to meet these enhanced requirements. So the good news is we have our sights set on what it would really take to move mobility in the future.
Well, that's great to hear. Let me ask you a bit of a follow-up, which I probably know the answer to, but given the threat, isn't air and missile defense of hubs like Guam a really high priority from AMC's perspective?
Yeah, you bet it is. It's absolutely important. Look, our bases are not sanctuaries. They're fighting positions now, okay? They have to be defended. But as you suspect, you know, we need to focus on a layered defense, right? Which includes new concepts of operations. Dispersal, reducing time on the ground, deception, hardening, using fuel bladders versus, you know, static fuel farms. You know, iron mountains are targets, okay? It's not the way we're going to do things. That's why we need agile combat employment, using our multi-capable airmen to create small, agile teams to move forward and generate that combat power. Now, we deliberately have been working these kinds of concepts into our exercises at every opportunity. Most recently, Pacific Iron, Mobility Guardian 21, and our wings are training daily to these concepts. In fact, our Air Force Expeditionary Center has been busy creating training syllabi to scale multi-capable airmen training across the Air Force, providing a new foundation in expeditionary skills that would be absolutely necessary in this era of strategic competition.
Well, General Slick here, in your white paper that we published at Mitchell this past April, you talked about how air mobility is accelerating towards a new culture that's focused on expanding rapid global mobility's comparative advantages over our opponents. So have you seen this cultural paradigm shift begin to take place? And if so, can you let us know how?
Yeah, you know, it's been about a competitive mindset taking root in Air Mobility Command. We're shifting to become a force ready for what we've been discussing, a force that deploys, sustains, and connects the joint and coalition force by integrating within the overall scheme of maneuver. The cultural outcomes we're trying to drive towards are still the same things that I emphasize in the paper. A data-centric culture framed by learning and experimenting. A culture where our airmen are forward-looking with a safe-to-fail versus a fail-safe mindset. and the ability to harness technological advantage at the speed of relevance. So I am encouraged by the new tools that stoke that competitive mindset, like our Total Force Airmen. They're all joining Digital University. We have almost 700 airmen signed up. And the top classes that they're taking include things like Zero to Hero in Python and Web Development Bootcamp. And the successes we've seen in implementing virtual reality across our wings, especially in maintenance training, we've seen a decrease in the time and resources required for skill level training, saving valuable aircraft downtime as well. And then we see new courses that we've created for our enlisted tiers, focusing on strategic competition, innovation, coaching, healthy lifestyle management, and technology solutions. And I've watched discovery through experimentation, getting our airmen comfortable with operating in this new environment and making decisions real time and integrating those lessons learned into future iterations, getting those reps and sets across all of our mission areas. I think about air refueling. We're putting real-time information in the cockpit in the KC-135, providing secure data and information sharing between these platforms, providing tactical data link and shared situational awareness. Look, we're taking an airplane that's built in the 50s and extending its relevance for the 21st century fight. I think of the exercise Global Lightning, and we tested the ability of space-based internet connectivity for our air medical evacuation mission, where we live stream patient vitals to ground personnel. And we're now capable of video teleconferencing with distributed medical personnel to help those who are wounded on board the aircraft. And for our global air mobility support forces at the nodes, right, this is the connection to transmit real-time maintenance information to expedite repair times to start that process and getting supplies before the aircraft lands. Look, our culture, rooted in that data decision thinking, is encouraging constant learning and experimentation, which will continue to grow deeper with the small wins, eventually snowballing into those larger wins, right? I am so excited about the forward movement in the work identifying what data is necessary to make these better decisions at echelon and how we're going to get it into the hands of our airmen.
Well, General, it sounds like you've made some tremendous headway already. Are there some other areas where you'd like to see continued progress?
Yeah, I tell you, that's just what I want to focus on is that, you know, I think data is where we're going to make our money. You know, we need to know where we're at with the data and using it to make better decisions before we go into the physics of moving these supplies and people around the world. That is the data-rich environment that we're really trying to focus on. And frankly, as we talk about advanced battle management system, it's foundational that we get that into that system as well.
Well, communication is a huge aspect of the mobility enterprise. You need to know who needs what, when, along with the precision and status of all your assets. And the system that we built to track all of that was constructed in an era where we really didn't think about denied comm as being such a major vulnerability. How are you increasing resilience in this area? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's a great question, Dave. Resilience is essential in a contested environment where we risk really getting cut off. You know, we're focused on PACE planning, primary, alternate, contingency, emergency, to prepare for potential C2 devolution, given that we expect operations to be contested in multiple domains, frankly, starting with mission generation right here in the continental United States. You know, in the AOC, that means focusing on multiple pathways through a mesh network to increase our resilience, right, beyond line of sight and line of sight types of communications. For our aerial porters, I think about a real-time common operating pictures to understand cargo flows and demand worldwide. For our air crews and contingency response forces on the ground, the devolution means being ready and able to execute mission-type orders. Now, we did this in a agile combat employment scenario in a simulated contested environment during our Mobility Guardian 21. And what we found was that working through the PACE plan and executing mission type orders requires really a baseline connection to information to be effective. You know, we can grant authorities and empower our airmen, but absent critical information, it challenges their ability to make the right decisions at the right time. And so it highlights the needs to pursue ideas like local clouds on the C-17, moving computing power forward and allowing decision makers to have just the best information available when they cannot connect to the larger network or to the AOC.
Now, based on that, how do you see air mobility in the context of a joint all-domain command and control? You mentioned it earlier, but could you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, Dave. First principle is that logistics planning really needs to be integrated with all joint warfighting functions. It goes back to that connection, right? Mobility presence out into the theater offers a unique capability to serve as nodes, sensors, and servers moving data and information and reinforcing the C2 structure out there. You know, I see the Advanced Battle Management System Capability Release 1 onto KC-46 as a first solid step to realizing this capability. And we expect much more to follow, frankly. So as we move forward, we're going to be engaged to test, develop, and formalize the requirements to ensure that fielded capabilities increase our ability to sense, make sense, and deliver data all the way to the point of need for the decision-making and back to C2. Now, this is just one way that we can drive connection and interoperability with the joint force, but it goes back to our own situational awareness and survivability. So beyond just the KC-46 that we're hearing a lot about, it means expanding access to TAC Data Link across the fleet and our ground nodes, really attacking the training that goes along with that as well to ensure our crew force can be effective in using it. So that's what we're starting now. In fact, for the first time, we connected the KC-10 and the C-5 to the Tactical Data Link and Mobility Guardian 21. Going forward, that has got to be the norm. Tying it all together in Mobility Guardian 21, we use TAC Data Link for the first time to connect real-time a spare part requirement to an airplane that was airborne. This allowed a 135 on the data link to make sense of the problem of the information, decide to divert and get the necessary parts to turn around and deliver to an A-10 that was simulated grounded due to that part, right? We didn't have any of that information before. Frankly, as I talked to the squadron commander, the A-10 squadron commander, he said, I couldn't believe that you actually did that, and we were able to generate the sortie in time, right? Because we didn't know before. We weren't on the network before. That's why that's so crucial, Dave.
So, General, shifting gears and full spectrum readiness, your white paper talked briefly about the importance of people, platforms, and process. So what has AMC done to move the ball forward since April, and what needs to be done in those areas to maximize full spectrum readiness?
Thanks. Look, the people, platform, processes are absolutely vital to our full spectrum readiness, and we've really made some headway here. Now, I talked a little bit on the people side about the shifting mindset and culture to drive data and information focus. So I'm going to focus on platform and processes. But first, I want to mention personnel readiness, okay, because that's kind of key. It goes to making sure that our force is ready and resilient. Look, our wing leaders have been focused on creating time for airman resiliency and integrating high-end training. The Chief Staff of the Air Force's new force generation model is going to help us tackle both. And in Air Mobility Command, we're looking at ways to use the structure to really get at increasing those advanced skills with the stability that the force generation model provides us. Now, on platforms, we are full speed ahead on getting the more capable and survivable KC-46 to full operational capability, ensuring air refueling capacity and connecting the joint force. In order to do that, however, we need to retire KC-10s and some KC-135s now and push needed upgrades to those remaining KC-135s in the fleet. Over time, those 179 KC-46s, we're going to continue to recapitalize the rest of the tankers through a bridge tanker, okay, a non-developmental bridge tanker, while refining the requirements informed by the joint warfighting concept and the joint concept for contested logistics and our war gaming for what advanced AR needs to be and how we're going to mold the force of the 2040s. In our processes, I mentioned in the paper that we created the Commander's Initiative Group to synchronize our command efforts to get after this vision. We're getting the right problems in front of the right people to derive needed experimentation, and it's led to both air and ground experiments critical to enabling new processes for agile combat employment. I think about KC-135, hot pit refueling to decrease the ground time that we have demonstrated and fielded and scaled. I think about finding new uses for existing platforms with the Rapid Dragon experiment delivering palletized munitions, not to an airfield, but to a point in space. The next phase of that program is planned to include increased C-17 integration. Look, the big takeaway here, for people, it's about creating time and training opportunities to ensure their readiness. For platforms and processes, it's not only about doing things differently. Sometimes we need to be doing different things altogether. That's why diversity of thought is so important, along with that competitive mindset and critical thinking skills.
General, so what near and long-term modernization efforts do you see occurring within your command? And did you see any of these changes exercised at Mobility Guardian 21 or Red Flag this year?
Yeah, Dave, the force mix that we have now is different than what the Joint Force requires 25 years from now. The challenge, as you know, is getting from point A to point B, modernizing, but in a way that preserves the capability through that transition. So for the near term, we're leveraging every exercise opportunity to flesh out these new capabilities to project and connect the Joint Force in these contested environments. Mobility Guardian 21, Global Lightning, Pacific Iron, and we're making some real headway. In the long term, when we think about advanced AR, CX, the new airlifter out in the 2040s, and Agility Prime, connecting to a network is the baseline requirement. It's the price of entry in strategic competition. We have to be thinking about survivability and joint force interoperability across the domains. I think about vertical takeoff and landing, autonomous capabilities, platforms, attritables, all need to be on the table. I think about new ways. You may have heard Agility Prime is a $100 million program for the Department of Defense that leverages over $1 billion of commercial investment. We could see some definite utility in rapid global mobility here. I don't know exactly what technologies will be advanced out of this in terms of batteries or autonomous systems, but I do know that we most certainly will employ several of those as they come to fruition in the future. That leads us to a natural discussion on resourcing. And like the Chief of Staff of the Air Force has said repeatedly, these are hard trades. We need to strike the right balance between today and tomorrow. But the fact is, we have to meet the daily demands of the combatant commanders and prepare for long-term strategic competition into the future. Look, the rising sustainment costs of multiple aging platforms presents a tough resource challenge, even if we do add new and capable technologies to keep those old platforms relevant. So where we find gaps between what we have today and what we need tomorrow, we're accelerating experiments to field minimum viable capability. So that we'll have some of this now, but always with a focus on developing those future requirements to go into those new systems, Dave.
Well, ma'am, I loved your quick discussion about leveraging technology, seeing things like battery-powered airplanes taking off into intra-theater airlift. But I want to shift the conversation and understand your picture as we talk about commercial partners like the Civil Air Reserve Fleet, the private companies who fly military equipment and personnel into theater. They have obviously been a key aspect of the equation for a long time, but I'd have to imagine you'll focus them in different ways to continue to benefit from their capacity, but you got to keep them out of the high-risk zone. So I'm assuming that the days of 747s flying into bases in war are probably over.
Yeah, that's a great point, and it's a key capability that, frankly, is not often understood about what we do here in the air logistics business. Look, our nation's ability to project and sustain combat power is linked to commercial industry. The Civil Reserve Air Fleet flies 90% of our passengers and 40% of our bulk cargo around the world, right? And we leverage their extensive networks for access, which is really helpful. But we also rely on their command and control and their business networks to be secure, which can be a liability, right? You've seen it in the Colonial Pipeline issue that we had a couple of months ago and the Maersk malware attack that I spoke about earlier. So this highest risk zone that you mentioned may actually be a commercial company's dispatch center, which is why Air Mobility Command and U.S. Transcom are helping our commercial partners boost their cybersecurity, and why we have 26 carriers as part of the program for resiliency. But in the kinetic realm, we know there's going to be limitations on craft in the high threat areas, pushing transload locations further away and increasing the total force organic workload and potentially resulting in those longer delivery times. So we are really focused on what new CONOPS would be for that.
At the beginning of the episode, Slick referred to the Battle of the Atlantic, one of the most challenging logistics operations of World War II. A key part of winning that contest was armed escort from both the sea and the sky. Could you see a time when similar protection might be required for your mobility assets?
Yes, absolutely. But like, I think protection is going to be available in new ways, right? Beginning with countering those non-kinetic threats. That's why we're pursuing resilient position, navigation, and timing capabilities. Because as I mentioned earlier, I think that we're going to be threatened right from mission generation. But kinetic threats highlight, again, the criticality of our connection with the TAC data link, right? With rapid global mobility integrated into the Joint Force scheme, defensive caps may not need to be in the immediate proximity like in the old-fashioned escort days, but instead in position to counter threats given the level of situation awareness aboard all platforms in the Joint Force area, air, land, and sea. And of course, we're certainly investigating other on or off-board defeat capabilities in the mix. I think of the Gremlin program. That's a program that's exploring the possibility of air launch and air recovery of attritable unmanned platforms, which would have flexible payloads, which could be perhaps launched out of both C-130s and C-17s. So that's just one way we're thinking about threat protection of our highly valued assets.
I think you actually anticipated my next question, which was going to be that given that our fighter forces now are already stretched thin, are you looking at additive forms of air escort protection? And it seems to me that this is a place where uninhabited aerial vehicles could be a major player. And you just mentioned that with Gremlin. So thanks for that. I guess I'd also add that modern weapons, we do have to think differently than the old-time type of close escort because equipping your aircraft with modern weapons might also be a way to deal with advanced threats in the future too. So your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Looking at hard points, we are looking at a pod that's just a form, fit, function pod on air refueling that has power and could do things like electronic warfare, could carry something else as well. Definitely in the art of the possible, certainly a missile is definitely one each attritable that would be nice to have on some of our HAV aircraft.
Very good. Thank you.
General, I just want to give a quick shout out to all the tanker crews that we've worked with, not only, dragging us across ponds, but being on site and on station with us, for me personally, flying over Fallujah in Iraq and having those folks thinking as an agile platform, listening to our freaks, moving to be closer to us to get fuel to us faster so we could return to the fight. So thanks to them. But I also like to hear you share what you think aerial refueling might look like in this new construct that you've been talking about. And as I see it, there's two ways we can look at it. Steps we need to take to ensure that these aircraft survive, remain mission effective, but also areas where tankers can provide new mission capability, like your efforts on KC-46 and advanced battle management.
Yeah, thanks. That's the prelude to exactly where we're going. Air refueling in this new construct has to be more survivable and more able to facilitate joint force interoperability. So, thing one, again, connection is the baseline to having that. When you started in Afghanistan, we didn't have connection capability. We looked to TAC C2 to tell us where to go as tanker pilots. But now, putting them on the tactical data link, we'll be able to see exactly what needs to go on. If we need to go get somebody, we don't need to be told to do so. And frankly, TAC data link needs to be on all of our rapid global mobility platforms going forward. But as we continue to exercise and experiment with these ideas, we should also look to the emerging warfighting concepts and the current wargaming to guide our requirements for the advanced air refueling platform. I hearken to General Van Herk. He recently published an article in The War on the Rocks, where you stated that as a combatant commander, there were two things he could never have enough of: information and the time to consider it. Rapid mobility does both, right? Information, by having our global presence forward, feeding the advanced battle management system, linking the joint players, you know, fourth and fifth gen and fifth and fifth gen, processing data at the edge, and improving joint all-domain command and control, connecting that data to the decision maker. And the second part, increased time to consider that information, because air mobility is the fastest, most agile arm of U.S. Transportation Command, affording the combatant commander increased decision time for deployment and maneuver. So when I think about the baseline and where we need to go in tankers and in airlift, absolutely providing new capabilities for the joint force is first and foremost on our minds.
Well, thanks for that, General Van Ovest. I know we're getting tight on time here, but I would like to ask one more question. The Air Force is spending a lot of time looking at increasingly distributed operations to make sure that it can still project power even if major bases are attacked, as well as to complicate an enemy's defensive calculus. Now, it's obviously clearly smart thinking, but it also complicates your mobility picture. Could you speak to us a bit on just how you're looking to meet these new demands?
Yeah, thanks, Jay. It's the right concept, but I tell you, you know, distributed operations increases demand and decreases efficiency for rapid global mobility effects. So these concepts are going to require more than C-17s and C-130s going forward. We're going to need new kinds of capabilities, like vertical takeoff and landing, fast sea lift, autonomous barges, and increased interoperability with our allies and partners to support our supply chain and to support our prepo equipment, which will likely need to occur. So as you know, and our continued discovery and experimentation on what it's going to take to ensure that we can close those logistics chains so that the kill chain can be closed. Now, the mobility capability requirements 20 study that just came out recommended an additional intra-theater lift study, which I think is going to bear some great info and recommendations for multimodal way ahead in this space, as I think we need to be thinking outside of a pure airlift in those areas. And it also drives home the need that to do things smarter, to focus and accelerate towards decision dominance and make more effective, faster decisions, better understanding what the Joint Force Commander intends to do at echelon, and use information to beat some of the physics that we battle every day in the logistics realm.
That's very good. I hear all that. But at some point, let's go down to the bottom line here. Does this require more airlift capacity?
So, Dave, I think it requires a better understanding of the lift that's needed, right? The airlift capacity may be intra-theater. It may be inter-theater. The issue is timing for both hitting a conflict early on, right, the critical time during the initial crisis situation, and to be able to do a protracted conflict, right? I think there's two different answers there depending on what we're planning for. I know we want to plan for both. But I think that if we use our commercial partners in different ways, and we retain the capability that we have on airlift and augment that with other ways to get around theater, I think that we'll do just fine.
Well, General Van Ovest, thanks very much for your time today. This is an enormously important topic, and it's really encouraging to see you and your team pressing forward in such an aggressive fashion. So thanks again for what you've done in Air Mobility Command and what you're going to do in your next command. So congratulations and thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Dave. And I just want to say I'm really proud to work with the incredible Total Force Airmen of Air Mobility Command. It's really been awesome to watch them get after this, and I'm pretty proud to lead them. Thanks.
You bet.
And ma'am, this is Slick. I wanted to say thanks as well. And I also wanted to give a quick shout out to Colonel Kyle Krekel Benwitz, who contacted me, and he's been bringing me up to speed, having me do some homework on AMC and all the great things that you're doing, getting us really smart. And I know that he's getting ready to take Wing Command. And I just want to say thanks for him being a friend to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. And we're going to have a lot more AMC topics to talk about soon.
Okay, great. Thanks, Lee.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning in to today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.